All right. I want to welcome all of you to our Polar Connect event. We're really excited to be talking with teacher Amber Lancaster and the team with the Larissa Project. They're someplace out in the Weddell Sea near Antarctica, and today is April 9th, 2012, if you're in North America anyway. And in the next hour, we're going to learn more about what Amber and the science team on the ship have been doing over the last 3 or 4 weeks, and hear more about what it's like to be working on a ship down near Antarctica. But before we get going, a few things we need to tell you about the platform we're using today. First off, Amber and the team are on a ship, and their communications are limited. They are calling in by a satellite phone, so chances are that they will disconnect and reconnect with us a couple of times. So we may not know when Amber and the team drop off, but we'll try to get them connected with you as soon as possible. You will not be seeing any video of them or their pictures because of the communications. However, they do have the same slides that you are seeing, which should be changing in the center of your screen. And as we go along, we will relay questions in the chat room, which is to the left. And you can type in your question, hit enter, or if you have any other things you want to have us relay, we'll relay those to the team. At the very end, we'll also have an opportunity for those of you to ask your questions live. If you have a question that you do want to ask live or something comes up along the way, you can click the little hand icon that's above the list of participants. That raises your hand. It lets us know that you have a question. When it does come time for you to talk and ask your question live, you need to click on the talk button. Click it once to open the talk microphone, and click it again when you're done so that you don't get feedback in your system. If you're calling in by phone, you can press *6 to mute your phone and *6 to unmute it. This event is being archived, and we'll send out a link afterwards and post it on the website. And again, if you have a question during the presentation, you can type it in the chat box. We will relay it to Amber and the team, and then at the end, we'll have time for open live questions. So with that, we're going to go to participant introductions. We won't do those live today. What do you think?
No,
this is yeah, we won't do those live today because there's a number of you and we aren't sure how long the connection is going to last. So if you would please do so, type in the chat box where you are from and if you're with students, what school and how many students you got, and then that way we'll have a record of who joined us today. Before I turn this over to Amber, real quickly, the reason why she's down in Antarctica is she's part of the Polar Trek program. Polar Trek is a national science-funded project where we place teachers with researchers and so that they can get hands-on science experiences. Amber, your mom and dad say hello, and they also just typed in the chat to let us all know where they're from. So with that, I think we're ready to go. I'm going to turn this over to you, Amber, and we're on your first slide. Just cue us when you need to switch slides.
We get three. Hey, Amber, have you got two schools that just said hi? Mark Parisio is with his students in Colorado, and you have 18 of your marine biology students.
Great. Hi, everybody. I'm here with the Larissa Project, and Larissa stands for the Larsen Ice Shelf System Antarctica. Where there's a lot of different types of scientists on the cruise because they're studying many different aspects of the physical and biological conditions of the environment down here and how it's changing as ice shelves have been collapsing. So before I go anywhere else, if you could go to the next slide, I'm going to have each of the people who are with me say hello and tell us where they're from, what research institution they're with, and what their main area of study is. And so I'm going to turn this over to Maria.
Hi, everyone. My name is Maria, and I work as a phytoplankton ecologist at the University of California, San Diego, in California.
Hi,
Hi, this is Bruce Huber. I'm a physical oceanographer at the Lamont Doherty Earth Institute of Columbia University.
Hi, this is Amy Leventer, a teach at Colgate University, and I'm a marine geologist.
Great. So if you could go to the next slide. This is a fun picture of me holding a giant sea cucumber that we pulled out from the bottom of the seafloor a couple of weeks ago. And so it's one of my favorite pictures of the trip so far. All right. Can everybody hear us still?
Yeah, you're doing great job, Amy.
So on to the next slide. I want to introduce you to the boat that we're on. This is the Nathaniel B. Palmer.
Oh, Amber, are you still there?
Yeah, we're still here. Can you hear us?
Yeah, you do cut in and out every once in a while, so we lose a few words, but I think you're okay.
I think we'll do good.
All right, just let us know if we disappear, because we won't know otherwise. So this is a research vessel and also an icebreaker. It's almost 179 feet, which is almost the size of a football field. And it's about 5 stories tall. And if you look at the front of it, you can see the ice tower. And that's the tallest part of the ship, where you can climb up to the very top and see all of the ice that's around us. You can go to the next slide. This is a map of where we've been so far. So we and we've gone through the Straits of Magellan and then out into the Drake Passage. And the Drake Passage is where the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans come together. And then we went down into and around the Antarctic Peninsula. And so you can see we spent a lot of time, particularly in one area called Search and exploring the area there. So that's where we've been so far, and we're slowly heading back up towards South America. We still have another week of research to go. All right, you can go to the next slide. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what it's like to live on a ship. This is my bedroom and my bathroom. You can see they're pretty small in places. It's pretty cramped. I share a room with another researcher on board, and she has the top bunk. That's my messy bunk on the bottom. And you can see that we have TVs and phones, and so you might think that we're able to see a lot of things. We get is information about what's going on, where we're at, what the wind speed is, and also views of different sides, different parts of the ship. So we only get video from on the ship itself. And the phones don't really call anywhere except other rooms on the boat. In order to call back to the United States, we have to get on a special phone that's a satellite phone in order to talk to anyone else. So I have a bathroom, and my bathroom also has a shower in it, so I'm able to take really hot showers whenever I want. But that's my little home. So can you go to the next slide? People always ask about the food. Our amazing chef who has been preparing us food. You can see we get soup every day. There's a salad. A couple things about the food, though. You can see that at one point on the ship, we still had lettuce and pineapples and really delicious fresh food. But at this point, we don't really have any of that anymore. We've been here long enough that we don't actually, we don't get to actually eat anything except for canned foods at this point, mostly, because it just doesn't last for that long. The other thing to know is that we have 4 different shifts of eating. And so there's 3 meals during the day, and then there's another meal at midnight called midrats or mid-rations or midnight rations. And so people get up, because we're working 24 hours, there's groups that are on from noon to midnight, and then there's groups that are on from midnight to noon. And so there has to be food to feed everyone. So there's actually 4 times of the day that you can eat down in the galley. All right, next slide. This is a picture of some of the stuff that we do on board for fun. You can see there's a lounge with students who are watching a movie. There's the exercise room. Challenge, but kind of fun. And lately, they've been a ginormous foosball tournament on board. It's been very competitive. There's been 16 teams playing, this is just a shot from that tournament. In addition, we just recently had an Easter egg hunt on board, and last night there was a dance party in the lounge, so there's always something new and fun happening on board when people get off shift. You guys could go to the next slide.
Hey, Amber, real quickly, since you had you were showing all the food, somebody wanted to know, how does Amber's vegetarian diet handle all the food options?
I've been doing vegetarian tea. In fact, I think there's about 3 or 4 vegetarians on board. It was a little better when we had fresh fruit and veggies, but I'm doing just fine. I made friends with the chef. I think that's the important thing to know. If you make friends with the chef, you always can eat. All right. Where are we? Are we on my luggage picture?
That's correct.
All right, so this is just a picture I took at the very beginning of the trip. People always ask what to bring. I brought all these clothes, and I haven't worn half of them because, in actuality, I end up wearing really warm clothing all the time. So if you go to the next picture, this is what I wear most of the time when I'm here, because when we're working on deck, you have to wear certain clothes. And so you have to wear these float coats, which are bright orange. Overboard, they'd be able to spot you, and they'd keep you afloat, and they're really well insulated, so they keep you really warm. And then almost always they have a hard conditions happening out on the boat. And so these are just kind of some of the things that I wear a lot of the time, just basically to keep warm. So some of the things that we've seen, if you go to the next slide, I just like to show people the ice that we've seen. There's two really big is the ice that forms from the water when it freezes, and then there's the type of ice that it has broken off from glaciers. And so on the left side, you can see sea ice and pancake ice. That's when the fresh water freezes on the surface of the sea, and eventually that pancake ice will get cold, and those pieces will actually form together to create a solid layer of sea ice. And then the icebergs, which are really, really tall, you can tell they're icebergs because they're so large, that have come off of a glacier. So they've broken off and are floating in the sea itself. And then if you go to the next slide, I just want to share some of the beautiful creatures we've been able to see. Minke whales, that was right off the back of the boat as we were doing a mooring installation, which you'll hear about later. Dolphins, which we saw as we were still near Chile. Seals, and I saw some to have a whole bunch of emperor penguins come by, and we've seen a lot of different types of penguins and seals, but just to give you a clue as to what we've been able to see. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Bruce and have him introduce what he's talking about and some more about the ocean and ice interaction.
Thank you, Amber.
Okay, hi, this is Bruce. As I mentioned before, I'm a physical oceanographer. That means that I study the physics of ocean circulation, and one of our specialties with the group that I'm working with is the interaction of the ocean with the ice. In particular, we're interested in looking at ice shelves, which are floating glacial ice that actually floats on the surface of the seawater. It's fed by glaciers that come down from the continent and form a large layer that literally floats on top of the salt water of the ocean. In many parts of Antarctica, there are these floating ice shelves, and they sit on top of the ocean and interact with the ocean. They exchange heat and fresh water. The ocean is actually warm enough, even though it seems cold. It's minus 0.8. Celsius, or about 28 degrees Fahrenheit. It's still warm enough to melt some of that ice. So there's some interesting processes that go on, one of which is that if the ocean gets warmer or we move more water under the ice shelf, it can actually melt. Ice shelves normally grow and shrink as this balance between glacial ice and ocean melting changes over the years. But in 2002, the Larsen B ice shelf, the one in the middle on the next slide, actually broke up into thousands of icebergs and drifted away, and we're very interested in trying to understand why that happened so suddenly, and also to try to understand what the impact of that sudden disappearance of the ice shelf was on the ocean, on the marine life that lives in the ocean, and on the marine life that lives on the bottom of the ocean that was once covered by this floating ice shelf. Okay, on the next slide, this is a schematic of all of the processes involved in that ocean ice shelf glacial balance and how they interact with the various forms of sea life and the atmosphere and the chemistry. It's a little complicated, but the thing to understand from this particular figure is that the ice shelf floats on the water actually flows under the ice shelf in one place and comes back out again. And what I'm particularly interested in is how that process occurs. How does that water flow underneath? What happens to the ice shelf when it comes in contact with the ocean? Does the ice shelf cool the ocean as it does in some parts of Antarctica, or does the ocean melt the ice shelf? So in the next slide, in order to understand this balance, we also have to know what's happening with the glaciers that feed the ice shelves. And to do that, we have instruments installed on the continent called AMIGOs. These measure the ice motion using GPS, like the GPS in your cars. They also have meteorological stations on them to measure wind, air temperature, radiation from the sun, and they also measure snowfall. One of the things that's important about understanding glaciers and ice shelves is how much snow falls on the top of the plateau that feeds the glaciers. More snow means more glaciers form, the glaciers move, and they move out onto the ice shelf. The next slide shows some of the instrumentation that we use on the ocean side of this process. On the left is an instrument called a CTD, which stands for conductivity, temperature, and depth. One of the important things to understand about the ocean is the distribution of temperature and salt, what makes the ocean salty. These are not constant with depth or with position in the ocean, so we have this particular instrument that measures these electronically. It's lowered from the ship all the way to the bottom and all the way back. In addition to measuring the temperature and salinity, we also collect water samples in those gray bottles, which are snapped shut when we send a command when it's under the water. It brings the water back, and the biologists and the geochemists and the geologists draw water from those and analyze them in the laboratories for whole plankton samples and geochemical parameters. In addition to looking at the temperature, salinity, and collecting water, we can actually measure the water speed and direction at the same time using something called an ADCP. That stands for acoustic Doppler current profiler, and if anybody has questions about that later, we can try to answer those for you. That's the instrument on the right. It has four discs on it, which are actually little transducers that send out pulses of sound. They listen for echoes, and by timing when those echoes return, we can calculate how fast the water is moving and what direction it's moving in. Then one more set of instruments that we use on the next slide are oceanographic moorings. These are strings of instruments and funnels that you see there are sediment traps for collecting particles and biological material that rain down through the ocean. There's a big weight at the bottom, which you can see on the left there. The string of instruments is held taut by floats that we put at the top, which you can see on the lower right. Floats, by the way, are glass balls. You'd think maybe that those were very fragile, but in fact they're quite sturdy. They're about half an inch thick, and they can withstand pressures down to 6,000 meters in the ocean bottom. We've put out four of those moorings so far, and we're going to come back next year and collect them, collect the samples from the sediment traps, and collect data from the instruments that we put on the moorings, like the one you see in the upper right. So I'm going to pass now to Amy.
Hold on a second, Bruce. Come back. We have a question for you. Somebody wants to know, how dangerous was setting the AMIGOs?
Setting the AMIGOs was done by a team of ice experts from University of Colorado last year, and it was quite ambitious and a little bit dangerous. They flew to their site in aircraft called Twin Otters, and they got there by first stopping off at a British base called Rothera on the other side of the peninsula, loading all of their gear into these Twin Otter aircraft, and then flying up to the plateau and camping there for several days while they put up these Amigos. They enjoyed it a lot. They have a lot of fun, and we have great communications, and we always have backup safety plans, so it's not really that hazardous. But like anything else down here, you have to be very careful, and you do have to get a little bit of training and know what you're doing.
All right, great. Thank you very much, Bruce. We'll see if we have questions at the end for you.
Hi, this is Amy, and I represent a team of scientists whose contribution to LARISA is to look at the mud that you can see in the picture there. We're looking at sedimentary records to try to decipher the history of the Larsen ice shelves. We're looking at both the recent breakout that happened in 2002 and earlier, and then we're trying to look at others that might have occurred in the longer-term past, say over the past 10,000 years. And what we're trying to do is to figure out how stable or unstable are these ice shelves and how does their instability relate to changes that take place in climate. In the next slide, you can see some of the things that we and our students do over the course of every 24 hours. Our responsibilities first include standing a watch. And so at every moment on the ship, there is somebody who's sitting at this navigational table. And they monitor and record all the data that's collected from the underway instruments. This includes all the navigational data.
Amy, this is Sarah at Polar Trek. I'm going to stop you just for a second because people seem to have garbled sound once again. Do we still have you there, Amy? Can you hear me?
We can hear you great.
Okay, that sounds good. I just don't want you to have to repeat too much, so if you can hold on for a second. Can people hear Amy again? This is Sarah, but Amy, can you say one more thing and we'll see if we can hear you? Okay, still garbled. Is the sound from Polar Trek also garbled?
No, the sound from Polar Trek is great. Is that better?
Yeah, it's the schools and the participants on the other end that are having trouble. So how about can Bruce was pretty clear and Amber was clear, so Amy, you might have to resituate yourself around the phone so you're
Can people hear me now?
We at Polar Trek can hear you, but the participants find it garbled at the moment. So it might be something with the satellite. We're not sure.
All right, so they're having trouble. Are you having trouble? The participants, you need to say whether it's, when you say it's interference,
all.
If it's all of us,
mm-hmm.
including Arcus, yes? Okay, on the phone, it's okay. So it's the satellite connection. Thank you for the class to responding there. So just try to situate yourself around the phone as best you can and talk slowly and maybe even a little bit louder than you normally would.
Okay, I'll talk really slow, and I'll just say a few things. So I'm starting with the image where you see the students who are standing watch. And what these students do are monitor and record all the data that we get while we're underway. So they keep track of our navigation and all of our geophysical data and also all the meteorologic or weather data. And we do this every Is that pretty clear?
It was. You broke up at the very end. There's some people that are going to just join by phone. So just keep going. It's all right.
Okay, on the next slide, you can see the kind of maps that we make of the seafloor. And what the maps do are help us understand how the glaciers on land have grown or shrunk over time. And in this image, for example, you can see that there are some really deep areas in blue, and these are areas where glaciers used to be grounded when there was much more ice here. And then we try to use those features to look at how the ice has changed over time. The thing that we do is we take samples of mud from the bottom of the ocean. And the way this works is that it's kind of like a history book, that the mud at the very surface of the bottom of the ocean maybe got deposited yesterday. And as we go deeper and deeper with our sediment cores, we're going farther and farther back in time. And so the picture that you see here of the Jumbo Piston Core, this collects our longest cores. We can get cores that are up to 80 feet long. And in the upper right, you can see the sign that says danger. And when this core goes over the side, it weighs over 5,000 pounds. And the wire that lowers to the bottom of the ocean is under a lot of tension. To do that, nobody's allowed to go outside.
Wow.
In the next slide, you can see one of our shorter cores. This is a casting core. And these just sample shorter amounts of time. And we sample these onboard ships. This takes about 10 to 12 hours to get all the different samples for analysis later. The next slide that you see is just a picture of the mud that we collect, and so we carefully log and then sample pretty much every centimeter. We don't throw any of the mud back overboard. It's all put into different kinds of vials and bags, and then we do a variety of different kinds of analyses on that. And the next slide shows you one of the things that we do. Any extra mud that we have, we sieve. And we do that to collect any of the sand and gravel that's there. These are carried by icebergs and deposited in the ocean. And when we look at the composition of the sand and gravel, it tells us about the geology that's hidden under all the ice on the peninsula. Another thing that we do with all of the material is to look at the microscopic plants, which you see on the left, and the microscopic animals, which you see on the right, the diatoms and the forams. These are organisms that live in the ocean, and they tell us about the environment that they existed in at the time that they were deposited, either yesterday or 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago. And they tell us things like, was there a lot of meltwater at the time that they lived? Was the temperature of the ocean warmer or colder at the time that they lived? And this can answer the questions that we have about why the ice shelf broke up. And we can do this as long as we have some kind of a link to how they live in the modern ocean. And so that's what the biologists are doing.
Hello, this is Maria.
And hi, Maria.
I'm going to speak for the biologists and ecologists on the cruise. What we are trying to do is understand how the algae and the animals have invaded this area that used to be covered by the ice shelf, but now is open water, and is exposed to the air and the sun. And we are working on three main areas. The animals and plants that live in the water, the ones that live at the bottom of the ocean, and then the ones that live inside the sediments, the same way that Amy just showed how the diatoms and the forams live in the sediments. She looks at the ones that have lived there before, and we look at the ones that are living there right now. If you look at the next slide,
you can call in.
Hello?
Hello, and then we do have people that just are joining by phone, so hold on, Maria, let me tell them what to do. If you're joining by phone, you need to *6 your phone to mute, otherwise we'll get feedback from you. *6 to mute your phones, *6 to unmute them. Thank you.
I *6 my phone?
Press *6 and you'll mute your phone, because I heard you ask that question. So, okay, go ahead, Maria.
So I'm in the slide number 29 on phytoplankton, and these, we are studying the little cells that float in the ocean, absorb the light, and make up new carbon. These are similar to the plants on land, like the vegetables and the fruits. But the main difference, if you see in the next slide, is that the water is very blue, so we don't see these plants. They are very sparse, so we need to concentrate them. And one way we do that is by filtration, meaning that we concentrate all the plants in 1 gallon of water in a little filter, and from there we study what they are and maybe the things that have inside the cells, like carbohydrates and proteins. One of the things we do then in the next slide, number 30, is look at the light in the ocean, and we use a profiling radiometer to look at how the light is absorbed in the water, and usually there's light in the top 100 meters and then it disappears and you get into dark waters. We also look at the algae and other animals in the ice. So if you look at slide 31, you can see people being moved from the ship onto the ice in something that we call the people's basket on the left. And then on the right, you can see how we get the sea ice samples with a core. In that day, we also had penguins coming to visit when we were sampling the ice. So the people that work on looking at the animals that live at the bottom of the ocean, they sample with a megacore that is number 32, which is similar to the CTD that Bruce showed up, is a ring of cores, which are tubes that are deposited in the bottom of the ocean, and then they are pushed into the sediments, and they bring up the mud and the animals. And in the bottom part of that slide, you can see the animals after the mud has been cleaned out. They also collect animals with a big net, and that's shown in the next slide, number 33, that we call a trawl. It's basically a giant net that is dragged through the bottom of the ocean collecting animals, and it's a lot of work to clean up all the mud and then separate all the animals and give them names. And you can see there in the picture how Amber has been a big help doing all that work. It's also pretty cold and wet, so everyone there has to keep warm. Then another way of looking at the animals at the bottom is through photography. And in the number 34, on the left side, you can see how something that we call a yo-yo camera, that it's a frame that has lights and a camera. And on the right, you can see the type of pictures that the camera takes. It's just looking down into the sediments and taking pictures of the sea stars and sea pigs that you can see in the picture. Finally, there's another way of collecting samples, and that is shown in the whale moon lander number 35. And for that, we put in the ocean that orange contraption that you see on the left, which is kind of a box, open box. They hang whale bones from there. Whales, when they die, their bones live in the ocean for a long time. So we collect those bones, we put them in this lander, and we leave them for 1 or 2 years. And the animals like to eat those bones. So on the right-hand side, you can see little worms that are collected by the bones. And then we study those worms. And finally, there's also someone on the ship looking at bacteria.
Hello? We're getting feedback from somebody. So did we lose?
Just joined, perhaps. Press *6 on your phone.
Maria, are you still there?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay.
All right. I think we're back on here. Go ahead, Maria.
Okay, so I was talking about the slide number 36, in which the people that study microbes or bacteria and also viruses, they look at the sediments the same way Amy explained. They take a core and they take pieces of mud from the core, and then they look at the bacteria inside the core, inside that sediment. And it could be which bacteria there are or how many, but also what the bacteria are doing. Are they using oxygen to respire, or are they using some other chemical to live? Finally, in number 37, it shows something that we call the glove box. That is a big plastic box where we keep the air inside without any oxygen. So it's flushed with nitrogen. And the reason we do that is to work with bacteria that do not like living under oxygen conditions because the oxygen is toxic to them. So they need to work in an environment free of oxygen. And from the core and from the glove box and from the tubes, the next slide shows everyone then going to the lab and making measurements out of the bacteria living in that environment. The last slide summarizes in number 39. It's a map very similar to the one Amy showed, but in a bigger scale, in where the white points show all the stations where the ship went in the last 3 weeks or 4 weeks. And at each of these stations, we did everything that we explained so far. What Bruce explained for the physics and the ice, what Amy explained for the sediments, and for what I explained for the biology. So at each of these stations, we studied the system in all those aspects. And then as we then put a map of how those properties and processes change with space and time, then we can start answering our main question of how the ice shelf has affected the system and how the animals and plants are now living in this newly open system. So if you have any questions, we are all here welcoming them. Thank you.
All right, thank you. So we already had a class that had to switch out here, but they said thank you for letting them join. And they got their phone, so they were good. I think a number of people ended up having to switch to a phone or connect through Skype because for some reason the satellite isn't working very well through our online platform. But if you have questions, you can click on the little hand icon above your above the participant list, and then you can ask your question live. And if you're using a phone, when you do so, you can press *6 to unmute your phone, and that will be one way to do it, or you can talk through the computer. Okay, well, let's hear from Amber's class. So go ahead and state who you are and what your question is. So Melissa from Amber's class wants to know why are the rigs named Amigo?
Why are the rigs named Amigos? Well, Amigos stands for Automated Met Ice Geophysics Observing Station. I have a feeling that they came up with the name Amigos before they came up with the acronym, to tell you the truth. But it does describe what they meant.
All right. Thank you. We'll go to Chris's class in Los Angeles. Would you like to ask your question live? Click on the talk button or *6 to unmute your phone.
Hi, this is Ms. Solis in Los Angeles. And our question from Jocelyn Lopez, are there ever any scary situations on the ship?
This is Amber. I would say that I haven't experienced a single scary situation on board yet. Nothing that we've done has been scary at all. Certainly, icebergs are really big, but we have a really great captain who makes sure to keep our boat safe. And since I've been here, nothing scary has happened on the boat at all.
Oh, cool. So nothing dangerous yet.
Okay. Go ahead, Amber's class. Go ahead and ask your question live. No. Okay. I'm going to relay what they wrote. Roshane wants to know, what are the specific types of animals that cannot be exposed to oxygen And it says in parentheses, from the glove box.
All right. Iris, I'll send this over to Maria to answer that.
She wrote that question.
Hey, Chris.
Hello?
Christina, we can hear you, Christina. So if you could start with your phone, that would be great.
All right. Go ahead.
Hello? Okay. Any organisms that don't like oxygen or they live in anoxic conditions are bacteria. And different from us, we take up oxygen and make up carbon dioxide as a byproduct because our cells need the oxygen. These bacteria use things like nitrate or methane, other chemicals, and they use that as source of energy, and then they make up other chemicals. Instead of carbon dioxide, they can make up, for example, nitrite. So it's not that different, but we are called oxic organisms, and they are called chemoautotrophic organisms, meaning they are, you know, exploiting resources that animals that need oxygen can't.
Okay, great. So Henry from Castor's class would like to know, are researchers allowed to step off the boat, and if so, what can you do?
All right, I'll start this, and then I'll have Amy talk a little bit about some of the work they've done. I haven't been able to go off the boat yet, but geologists and biologists were able to go off the cruise and explore one of the islands nearby because they wanted to take a rock.
Amy, and early in the cruise, a group of geologists got off onto a little island called Robertson Island, and we were collecting rocks that had in the past been covered by the ice when it was bigger, and as the ice shrunk, the rocks got exposed, and so we do an analysis called cosmogenic exposure age dating, and what that does is it tells us the length of time that those rocks have been exposed to sunlight, and we can use that to look at the history of the ice in the past. And I'll pass the phone off to Maria. She's been off looking at the ice.
Hi, this is Maria. Another way that we got off the ship was by going to the sea ice. We look for floes that are big and thick enough, meaning they are safe to step on. And four or five people then go onto the ice, and we spend there a few hours making an ice core, a sea ice core, and bringing that ice onto the ship to study the algae that live there.
Okay. So, Amber, we have another student, Mashan from your class, wants to know if you miss her and are you having fun and what do you miss about home?
Of course I miss. I'm starting to miss the most from home is, one, teaching all of my students because I really miss you guys, but I'm also really I've been on the boat now, and you guys know that I love to cook, and so when you're on the boat, you're just eating the food that's there every day, and so I really miss being able to make all my favorite foods. Although the food is great, I'm not complaining at all, but I just miss being able to cook. But mostly I miss you guys.
Sweet. Okay, it looks like they have another question coming up here, so... And while we're waiting for the question, when do you anticipate being home? Can you tell us that?
Oh, yes. When I'm coming home?
Yes.
Oh, I will be back in 2 weeks. So we have about another week of science, and then we have about big passage. It takes a while to get across that big space between the Antarctic Peninsula and South America. And then once we get back to South America, there's a lot of work packing up samples and making sure everything's ready to go. And then it takes about 2 more days to get back to San Francisco. So I should be back, hopefully, I think I just got my travel plans. I'll be back by April 23rd. So that's almost 2 weeks exactly from today.
All right. So, Alexis from your class wants to know, do you guys have snowmobiles or snow sleds to use on the ice when you go out?
Hold on, let me pass this to Bruce.
Yes, on some cruises we do carry snowmobiles. On this trip we don't need them, so we didn't bring them along, but oftentimes when scientists come down here, they have to move heavy things on the ice and they use snowmobiles. They did use some snowmobiles early in the project to tow something called ice-penetrating radar across the ice dome on the peninsula to try to measure the thickness and the layering in the sea ice. They really enjoyed that because they got to drive around for several days towing this little cable behind them, eating food they cooked in tents and generally having a good time while the rest of us were out here on the ship 24 hours a day doing what we like to do on the ship.
Okay, great. One more class from, or one more, another question from Amber's class, and then we'll go live here. Ivana wants to know, does moving through ice negatively affect the boat?
It doesn't hurt the boat in any ways, but it does impact how fast the boat can go. And so because it's an icebreaker and it's designed to be able to go through ice, there aren't any structural damages that happen, but it does slow down how fast it can go. And in different types of ice, it can go faster based on what type of ice it is and how deep or how thick the ice is.
Okay, I'm trying to see if Ms. Sola's class would like to talk to you in person, so.
Yes, I have a student, Nayeli, and she wanted to ask, what is the daily temperature outside like?
Well, lately, when we... Down, I don't know, 30 to 40 degrees. It was nice. You could go outside in a jacket, but it wasn't too cold. Right now, I think I just saw that it's about negative 16 degrees Celsius, which is roughly about 0 degrees outside. And so in order to stand outside on the bow now, you need to wear really, really warm clothes, lots of layers, gloves. Not only was it really cold, it was also really windy, and so none of us could stay outside for more than 20 or 30 minutes before having to go back inside to warm up our hands. But it's definitely gotten colder. Winter is happening down here because we're in the southern hemisphere, and so it's gotten colder, especially as we move further down and we've gone.
Oh. Are you there?
I'm still here.
Okay, you cut out there for a moment. So your class has only about 4 more minutes, and they have another question. Brian wants to know, has anyone gotten sick? What is the process of someone who gets sick, and are there any doctors on board?
Well, I think a lot of students and some researchers probably felt a little seasick during the Drake Passage, but no one else is, to my mind. There are no doctors on board, but there's a bunch of people who have some training to assist with that. There's a supply of medicines on board. A lot of it is doing the best diagnosis they can, and they can consult people back in the States if there's a real problem where people need more substantial help. But so far, we've all stayed pretty healthy. We still have to go back over the Drake again, though, so I imagine some of us may not be feeling too well.
Okay. Making sure they have all the classes. So Robert Vodman wants to relay a message to you from Amy and himself, a high five and a hug to Cara from her mom.
Roberta. Sorry about that.
Oh, Roberta. Sorry.
All right, we'll let Karen know that she says hi.
All right, so your class wants to say goodbye to you live, since I'll let them open their mic, turn on the phone, and they'll take off, okay?
Hi, this is Mr. JR. Can you hear me clearly?
Yes, go right ahead.
All right, y'all, go ahead.
Bye, guys. I'll see you in a couple weeks.
Thanks, Ms. Lancaster. Have a good one. Get home safe.
Thanks.
All right. So we have a lot of people that that were signing on or signing off. So we want to say thank you for joining us today. And you guys did a great job there on the Palmer. It was nice to hear your voices. And we'll be sending out the recording, the archive here in the next couple of days and posting on the website. You guys have a good 2 weeks left of your expedition, and we look forward to following you on your journals.
Great, thanks so much.